Welcome back to the Hoops People Podcast. Y'all know me, Nathan Schwartz. Joining me from New Zealand, Dylan Williamson.
Good morning, Nathan.
Good evening. How are you feeling? Your Clippers, last we talked, you were feeling really good. They had just beat Dallas. Then all broke loose.
That's right. It's been so long since we've talked that the last time we were on, we were celebrating a Clippers victory. Looked like they were going to escape the first round without Kawhi Leonard before it all came crashing tragically down. Game one, James Harden, and game five and six, James Harden are sadly not the same player.
Very different players. Still James Harden. He's still exactly who we thought he was. Well, do you want to with Dallas?
Sorry, go ahead.
Do you want to start with Dallas? Do you want to jump right into Mavs Thunder?
Yeah, let's do it.
All right. Do you know what PJ Washington was shooting during the Clippers series?
From the field or from three?
From three.
I feel like it wasn't that good, but he seemed to make them whenever at like the biggest moments. Was it like 30%? But it was like 60% on like go ahead shots.
I don't know what it was on go ahead shots, but over the first, over the six games against the Clippers, it's 31%. Counting the last game against the Clippers. So since game six, games one through three against the Thunder. So his last four games, he is shooting 52.9% from three. On 8.5 attempts, he's averaged 20 points per game over the last four games. Really almost 27, 28, 29 last two games. He is the new Rui. He is this year's breakoff playoff sensation. Did you see it coming?
No, I feel like I almost like owe him an apology. I was very low on PJ Washington. I hated that move for them at the deadline. I was like, what are you guys doing? You need a 3-and-D wing and you're getting like a offensive scoring isolation power forward. Like, why is that your big move? But I think since getting to Dallas, he has really proved that, one, he's a better shooter than what he was able to show in Charlotte. And two, he's also a much better defender than I realized. In Charlotte, I feel like he was sort of like a defensive center who had like some advantages over other fives and that he was more mobile than them. But then couldn't defend the rim at all. So it was this very awkward defensive position of being a five that couldn't protect the rim. But like he guarded Paul George pretty well. He guarded James Harden, as well as, anyone except Derrick Jones did. So I think I do owe him an apology. He's actually a very solid role player and I think was the X factor against the Clippers and could be against the Thunder as well. We know what Kyrie is. Kyrie was very good, very reliable, a nice closer. Luka didn't have a good series. He had like one good game and it was enough to sneak through and wasn't good in game one against the Thunder either. And especially seems to wear out late in games, but does have Kyrie to take over. But it seems like PJ Washington can be the X factor. He was in the first series against the Clippers, I feel, and is seeming like he could be in this series as well.
Yeah, I mean, his long ball shooting has been insanely good. I can't believe how many open looks he's still getting. I feel like he's on this much of a heater. Like, okay, so you just camp out on him. Just make Derrick Jones Jr. shoot more. Make Green shoot more. Make anybody but PJ Tucker, PJ Washington shoot more. Because it seems like they keep finding him. I think this has been a really interesting Kyrie series so far. He's been a little bit more muted scoring-wise, looking to pass a lot more. And playing some of the best defense in his life. I was listening to the Thinking Basketball podcast, and they called him Dallas's version of Draymond Green. That was words I would never hear, but I don't hate a take or that concept because he is playing a lot of defense, and then he's looking to set the other guys up. Like, Luka will have an action, the ball will hit Kyrie, and then Kyrie makes the connecting pass in a very Draymond Green offensive way, like just being the additional connector. How do you feel about what Kyrie's brought to the court thus far?
Yeah, no, I think that's a big reason that they were able to succeed in the Clippers series and have a decent chance against this Thunder team. In previous years of the Luka Mavs, it's been Luka does everything, and as soon as he gets off the ball, the offense totally comes to a standstill. And, those connecting pieces that were able to make plays when Luka gave up the ball in a, 4-on-3 situation weren't able to really take advantage of that. But Kyrie is a very high-level playmaker who can play that role, did play quite good defense as well. You know, he was one of the best defenders on James Harden in the first series, which is something that you probably wouldn't have expected coming into it. And in addition to that, I think just his skill set as a closer is very well suited to Luka, who is like a very good first half player, like does most of his scoring in the first half, mm-hmm. and has a tendency to wear down. Whereas Kyrie is like one of the all-time, you know, playoff closers.
Yeah. Luka is obviously hurt. He is I don't want to say moving through the motions, but like you see it as he's going. And like the refs have swallowed their whistle completely in a lot of these series. The amount of contact that him and Dort are having with each other. I found it really funny. Was it game three? There's a Dort drive and he pummels over Luka, and Luka's like, "What do you mean that's an offensive foul?" I'm like, "What do you mean that? Like, you're doing that to Dort." Like, there is so much physical contact going on between those guys. And Luka seems really kind of hampered by it. So I am hoping that he can kind of get through that. Do you have a preference for which big they play? I want to hear your takes. Like, Lively versus Gafford. What are you seeing out there? What are you liking or disliking?
I feel like they are quite similar. Lively seems to have more of provide more of a threat as like a vertical a vertical threat offensively. Both of them I feel like were pretty good defensively against through two series. Hacker Lively, a unique strategy. Ooh. We haven't seen a big man getting hacked in a long time, so maybe that is a reason to go away from him. Although I think he did make all the free throws that he was, or made a not all of them, but made a reasonable amount.
The initial one caught him off. Both of those, or maybe one of two. But when they went back to it again, he made four straight, and the Thunder just were like, "Cool, we're done with the hack a Lively."
I do love Mark Daigneault going to it. You know, you got to be creative in the playoffs, and him going to like 2015 Dwight Howard defense. You know, bringing back the old days.
I pulled up the Popovich fouling Shaq 5 seconds into a Sun Spurs game clip for my wife. I'm just like, because she was wondering what was going on. I'm like, watch this. Like Lively's just racing around the court.
She's like, why are they chasing this dude?
It looked like flag football or capture the flag. And it's just, no, it's we gotta catch Lively. So I feel like Gafford's the better player. When I watch them individually, Gafford seems to be in more of the right spaces defensively, more of the right spaces offensively, much more demonstrative defensively. But for some reason, it looks like the team is clicking better with Lively. It looks like Luka and Lively are boys up there. And I can't say it better than the vibes, but they seem to have really good vibes and really good connections. It's nice that they can always have both of them out there because Gafford keeps hurting himself. I think he smacked the backboard too hard and hurt his thumb, and then game two had hurt his shoulder. But it looks like the team is happier and more energetic when Lively's out there. So I was curious because I think Gafford's better. When I watch Gafford, I think Gafford is better, but the team is better with Lively. And that's just an interesting thing to me.
Yeah, and maybe it's like a little bit of that like rookie, you know, sort of proving yourself where he's just going to run harder than what Gafford is. You know, I was talking about him as a vertical threat on the lob, which is quite hard to do when Chet Holmgren is on the floor. But, you know, that's one example of a you know, the sort of effort or intention kind of play.
Yeah. Well, speaking of Chet Holmgren, we got the Thunder on the other side of the series. Down 2-1. With game four in Dallas, Chet has been struggling. His three-point shot not falling in the playoffs. He's 28% during the regular season. He was 37% from deep. So a pretty sizable drop. What adjustments or what are you thinking for OKC to get back in the series or even it up in game four?
I don't know that necessarily Holmgren's offense is going to be the thing that does it. Like it is difficult for them because of the way that they have succeeded through the regular season is by playing five out all the time. And when Chet isn't going to make shots, which does happen to young players in the playoffs, like the shots get harder. And Dallas does have some good, you know, quite mobile big men that can make closeouts and make that job difficult. The two big lineup, what did you think of that? Do you think that is a something that they could go to more? My biggest thing for them is like stop playing Josh Giddey, which they kind of did in game three. More Wiggins, more, you know, Isaiah Joe.
I like some of the Giddey moments. I came into game two knowing that Giddey was pretty much benched during the second half. And there were a number of good moments that I felt like he had, though, where he was the connecting piece. I think they need to move Giddey to the bench. I'd like to see more Isaiah Joe or potentially Kayson Wallace. I know he hasn't been great during the playoffs, but during the regular season, his shooting was big, and I feel like he's a good defensive presence. The Jalen Williams, the double big lineups, the Jay Will, J-Dub, and Chet. I really like those from a shooting spacing aspect. Did not play much during the regular season. Chet had his first assist to Jalen Williams in game three. First all year. So it's not very experienced, but if you have Chet needing to chase out to three-point shooters, OKC can't get a rebound. Like, there's no one with the body to box out either Gafford or Lively if Chet is trying to chase out a three-point shooter. Having Jay Will gives them someone who can, you know, put a body on those guys and contest for offensive, or in that case, defensive rebounds, which I think would be really big.
Yeah, and like looking at the box score from game three, you would almost think that the Thunder won. The one category that they really lost is they just got destroyed on the offensive glass. They shot a pretty good percentage. They didn't turn the ball over a huge amount. The one category that they've really just got destroyed in is the offensive rebounds. And so maybe more two bigs can help with that. We did know that this was going to be OKC's weakness, you know, to start the season. We knew that Chet wasn't going to be a great defensive rebounder, and they weren't throughout the season, but it didn't seem to matter. But now with 48 minutes of, as you say, Lively or Gafford, who are, you know, two really large athletic guys who can get in and get rebounds, and even like Derek Jones Jr., who's got the hops to make a play on the glass, you know, that losing the possession game through the offensive rebounds is something that they're going to have to overcome. And they don't necessarily have great personnel for it. Like their one move to address that was signing Bismack Biyombo, who, you know, won't see the floor in the playoffs.
Yeah, they helped Dallas make the Gafford trade, and that's going to hurt them. It's like, if they gave up protection on a pick to allow Dallas to trade another one or to swap for a pick back. I forget the exact details of the trade. I can look it back up. But they made a trade that enabled Dallas to make that draft pick trade to get Gafford. And I almost wonder why they didn't just send that pick to like Washington. Why don't you just cut Dallas out and just get Gafford? Because he could have been a really nice piece for them. But I felt like, so in the third quarter, Dallas won a 16-0 run. Once J-Dub got hurt, and like that injury looked bad. He was laying on the ground for quite a while. But while Dallas is playing around him, the ball gets offensive rebound, kicked out to Kyrie. And he like tries to get up and just can't get up to contest the Kyrie three. You know, you lost by 5 or 4 points with one of your best players getting hurt and missing significant time. That's probably why it feels like it should have been an OKC win. What are you predicting for the rest of the series? Feels like this is going down to game seven. You're taking Dallas, you're taking OKC.
I do think that OKC is still the better team. Like there are those very specific things that you can, you know, point at in terms of ways that you can swing a few points and in a close loss. You know, those are things that you can easily address. Well, not easily, but you can identify and try to address. It's not like they're, you know, being totally outplayed or they just don't have the talent to get it done. You know, send more guys to the boards and don't have your second best player get hurt. Don't give up a 16-0 run in the second half. Seem like things that you can identify. And I do think that OKC is still the better team. It'd be interesting to see how Luka plays throughout the later games of the series. You know, he wears down in second halves. Is he going to wear down in second half of the series as well? Although his best game was late in the Clippers series, so maybe that's not necessarily an issue. But I do still think that OKC is just the better overall team, and so I slightly favor them even though they are down at the moment.
Yeah, I do as well. It would feel incredibly bold to say OKC in six, but I do think that there's a good chance that they take game four. If they take game four, game five at home seems likely. It's going to be OKC in seven is what I'm feeling. But and part of what goes into that is just the Luka health. If he doesn't start looking better, it's sad. That's one of the things you always have in NBA playoffs is health as a factor. But I'm worried about how he's been. Speaking of moving,
if it comes down to Shea versus Kyrie, OKC takes that.
Yeah. Speaking of moving, though, let's talk Knicks Pacers because that game wrapped up today. This game was over, I'm going to guess, long before you were awake, considering it was like a 30-point blowout. I'm sure when you woke up and turned on the ESPN apps and started looking at it, you're like, yeah, I'm not going to waste my time watching this one. Did you catch any of the game?
Not at all. Not yet. Maybe I'll go back and watch the all positions. Great innovation from the NBA, can I just say. As much as I hate the NBA app and it's so bad in so many ways, all positions recap is a great innovation. So shout out to them for getting that one thing right. Do you want to give us the rundown? Why was it so one-sided? And do you think it is replicable? There we go.
So, I mean, like, the Knicks could not hit threes to start. They were 2 for 14 from deep. And it wasn't particularly bad looks for a lot of those. It was in the first half. But the Pacers came out with a lot of energy, a lot of intensity. Miles Turner had a stretch where he hit this three, first four or five possessions of the game. Shot clock is running down. He's like tossed the ball with like a half a second left. He's fading away over two Knicks who are like doing a good job closing out, and it swishes. Just beautiful shot from a like arc and going in aspect, but like off balance, didn't look comfortable. Hits that, comes down, blocks, I forget who drove, but he gets a block. Races up the court, gets an offensive rebound and put back, comes back down on defense, blocks another Nick, although Precious gets the rebound and puts it in. But it was just Turner in 3-4 possessions, 2 blocks, 5 points. And then, like, he didn't do anything for the rest of the first half. But moments like that where a single Pacer was just able to outwork the rest of the Knicks was huge. The Pacers were hitting threes. Johnson also looked a little hobbled. He had an early incident where he shot a three, and I want to say it was Nembhard. It was either Nembhard or Nesmith. Kind of landed under him. He jumped forward. They both kind of jumped forward a little bit. Just his ankle kind of seemed to bother him. And it wasn't a good showing from him. I do think this is the game that OG Anunoby should walk into Leon Rose's office with this offseason and say, this is why I deserve a max contract. You see how we won games 1 and 2. You see what happened when I missed game four. Like, give me the money. Give me all the money. I don't want to negotiate anymore. You see what it's worth to have me out there. That's just kind of where I'm at with this, with him. And I don't really know if the Knicks have enough pieces left. Like, they put in Jericho Sims, and then Pacers did a good job defending them, bringing the ball up, so much so that they had to kick it back to Sims as the inbounder. And he, like, takes one dribble, picks up the ball, and they get a 8-second violation. Where to go, and it's like, why is he in the game? Like, Gibbs is probably begging to have Taj Gibson out there right now. But like, why did he let him go? Taj would be playing half the game at this point.
Do you think there's anything to the almost like opposite ways that these teams play, where the Knicks are going to play very methodical and play their guys the whole freaking game, and then the Pacers play very quick and loose? Do you think that there is maybe like almost like a fatigue aspect where these guys have to play these big minutes and then the Pacers are trying to run at all times? Do you think that has anything to do with it? I mean, like, the Knicks came out, without having seen the game, came out very flat. I mean, getting outscored by 20 points in the first quarter, like, is horrendous.
That makes me think it's not so much a fatigue, because, like, if it's fatigue, they should bear down in the late game. And maybe that is what happened in game three, where the Pacers were able to better execute at the end, and Nembhard hit that big step, was it step back three, catch and shoot three, to you know, kind of ice the game. But, like, they just came out flat in the beginning. I think it's, at this point, just a lack of talent. I mean, all right, start of the year, Mitchell Robinson's supposed to be your starting center. He's out. So you play a guy who probably should be back up the whole year, Isaiah Hartenstein, although he has been fantastic. I know you're a big Hartenstein guy. At the power forward position, You had Julius Randle. He's out. You try shifting up OG Anunoby. He's out. Deadline deal. You trade for Bojan Bogdanovic. He's out. So you're on your third string power forward, who should be your third string center. That's your new starting lineup, is second string center, third string center. At the guards, or at the wing, you've got Hart, Dante, and Brunson. Those three, fine. You probably wanted Hart to be off the bench, or have OG at the three. So you're a little short there. Not having the two guys that they traded to Toronto, just having that depth, RJ Barrett and Quickly, does kind of hurt them, because Deuce has been fine. He's had some good defensive moments. There are some times where I feel he's too aggressive on offense. Like, he will drive, and that's whether or not it's a good idea. I like the fact that he's not scared by the moment, but they needed Alec Burks to have minutes for them today and produce things for them today. They're just, really digging off the scrap heap. I mean, Burks was a rough watch for the Detroit Pistons. People in Detroit were saying, why is Burks getting minutes on the Detroit Pistons this year? And now he's the guy they're turning to in the playoffs to try to juice some offense off the bench. Like, the Knicks just are dead.
Mm. You almost wonder whether McBride's over-aggressiveness is almost mandated, because outside of Brunson, do they have anyone else who can create a shot? Like you're saying, they're going to Alec Burks to be like, come on, give us some offense, man. or DiVincenzo, who's quite a good off-ball player, but not a creator.
Yeah, I mean, Josh Hart tried to attack against Tyrese Haliburton. I at least like that, because you're involving the Pacers, one of their best offensive players, not a great defensive player. Like, the Knicks just don't have a lot of options to try to go to score. A lot of guys, they don't have a lot of guys that can create their own basket. It is funny, when Brunson goes to the bench, Deuce is like the best guy for creating his own looks, and that's not a great position to be in. I think if OG doesn't come back, the Knicks are fucked.
Yeah, I mean, it's going to depend on Brunson too. Like, if he can play to the level that he has played throughout the season and throughout the first round, then he's the best player on the floor, and that always gives you a chance. But if he's not going to be 100%, or if he's not going to be able to, carry the entire offensive load, then Knicks might be looking like a 6-game series.
Yeah, I mean, I wish they still had McBride. Quentin Grimes, like they need someone else who can come in and do something, anything. I'm looking over their roster to be like, who might they be able to squeeze, a little something out? They put Shake Milton in the game today, but it's slim pickings because of how, I mean, there's four guys who should be rotation pieces, and it's a lot of the upfront stuff. Pascal is much bigger and stronger than Hart. I don't like seeing Hart try to defend him, but if you got Pascal and Turner out there, Isaiah Hartenstein picks up Turner, you need to have Precious for Pascal, and Pascal's going to cook Precious. I love Precious, but it's not a great matchup for him.
Yeah. Do you think there's anything that the Knicks can do other than Jalen Brunson just becoming, prime Steve Nash to make it a competitive series? To not get cooked like this. Like, they played really well in the first two games. Is there anything you think they can get back to, or is this going to be a trend? Have the Pacers sort of figured them out?
They're pretty worn down, limited. I saw that Ice Spice was at the game that that Dante DiVincenzo started cooking from. So maybe they keep inviting her. Maybe it's the Jordan Poole effect of, like, you get Ice Spice in the building.
They just need to get back home. So, it's pretty hard to get Ice Spice to fucking Bakersfield Field House or whatever it is. But, at MSG, they just got to get back to the garden.
Yeah. And Dante DiVincenzo, last four games prior to today. So not counting game four here, but last game of Philly, first three against Indiana. 28 points per game on 56% three-point shooting. You knew that was going to drop off at some point. Like, you can't stay that hot forever. Dropped off a lot today. If he can bounce back closer to that 56%, that's really going to help going back to Garden.
Nate, your prediction for the rest of the series?
Oh, God. I'm sorry to my Knicks fans in my life. Sorry, Richard. You're a dear friend, a lovely buddy. Sorry, Remy. Sorry, Daniel. I think it's going to be Pacers in six at this point. I just don't think OG's coming back, and I think the lack of remaining depth, being short four rotation pieces, it's kind of a miracle that took that much to knock off the Knicks.
Yeah. It's kind of reductive given that there are only three games left, but I feel like whoever wins game five is winning the series. Like, if the Knicks can pull one out with all the adversity that they're facing, then it's their series to win. But if they can't win at home, then it's, you know, it's over in game six.
Can I say, Reggie Miller's been doing some of the broadcasts. The man is like so openly cheering for the Pacers. It's great. Get Jeff Van Gundy there. I want Van Gundy and Reggie to announce these games. And it may get so bad that you have to like mute the TV. I want that back and forth. Like that will entertain me. Could get me through a game like today's, which was, if I had legs left, I'm in the process of moving, the listeners. So I've been physically moving the weights out of my basement into the new basement that I'm going to be living in, or the house that I'm going to be living at. So just like carrying up dumbbells, carrying up like plates. That was my day, and my legs were just shredded. And so I collapsed on the couch. I was like, man, I should probably do something else because this game sucks. I was like, I can't move. If there were other circumstances, I probably wouldn't have watched all of today's game.
All right. Shall we swing it back out west? What do you want to talk? Do you want to talk Celtics-Cavs?
Let's talk Celtics-Cavs just because I'm not going to have this thing edited and posted today, Sunday, that we're recording this. And so if someone's listening to this, I know what happened Denver tonight, Denver, Minnesota tonight. I will say this is the series I watched the least of. Let game one slip past me with Boston because I was like, about when Cavs won game two, I did go back and watch the game, and I watched parts of game three here. And my biggest take is just if Evan Mobley can be aggressive and attack the basket, Cleveland has a shot. But when he doesn't do anything, they're going to get roasted.
Mm. When you've got Tristan Thompson and Marcus Morris playing playoff minutes for you, it's hard to see the way that you succeed. And like, maybe you're right, but you know, the Celtics, the way that they can be exploited at the moment is by getting to the rim while they don't have Porzingis. Al Horford is a good defender in space, but not necessarily a great rim protector. And with the minutes he's playing, if you put more, you know, stress on him, maybe that's the way that you can get it. It's kind of rough for the Cavs. It seems like Donovan Mitchell is playing sort of almost as well as you could hope for. The Celtics have probably the best perimeter defenders, you know, in terms of depth in the league. And this dude's getting, you know, he's getting his 30 points on efficient shooting every game. And it is not enough to lift the Cavs to, you know, 100 points in a game.
Yeah. This has been a good second round for those wing defenders. I mean, you got Nikhil Alexander-Walker. You got Jaden McDaniels, was out in Minnesota having a good stretch here. Dort is getting his shine against Luka. I don't feel like there's been quite as much shine for White and Drew Holiday for what they're doing, but probably that's because Mitchell is putting up 30-plus points a night. I don't know if Mobley can be back. It doesn't sound like they fully know. He's been day-to-day, and it's a bruised rib, so it's kind of just, hey, when does this rib feel good enough to play? But all season long, Bonds go-to offense, when the threes weren't falling or when teams were selling out to try to stop them, was, okay, we've got a mismatch. We'll get Porzingis in the post, dump it down to him. And that was kind of their go-to in the half court, is get this mismatch, get it to Porzingis in the post, and then he can kick it or can score on the guy. Not having Porzingis there does really take away from one of the things they've been super successful with. You kind of saw it in game two where they didn't have like a go-to play or a go-to set to create things. And so I do kind of wonder if they have another off shooting night, can Cleveland steal another game? Can they somehow get this to game seven? I don't think Cleveland has enough, but if Allen comes back, maybe they do. What do you think?
Particularly for the Celtics offense, they've been getting really good performances out of Jaylen Brown. You know, he's a lot of times been their most effective offensive player. And, mm-hmm. you know, maybe you say that is repeatable because he's being guarded by Max Strus, you know, half the game. But you got to feel like you know, are you going to count on Jaylen Brown being the best player and the, you know, the best offensive player on the Celtics every game? If he has a normal game, does that drag their offense down enough that all of a sudden you're right back in it? And then, yeah, Jared Allen coming back, you know, maybe even more Tristan Thompson. Could Tristan Thompson actually be a difference maker? One of the Celtics' supposed weaknesses is, you know, you could get them on the offensive glass. Tristan Thompson, throughout his career, has been an elite offensive rebounder. Is this an opportunity for 37-year-old, whatever he is, Tristan Thompson to make an impact? Or even Jared Allen, who seems like a pretty decent matchup there.
It would be very funny if Tristan Thompson swung a game this series. Just after the steroid suspension and all of the just like, why is this guy even in the league? Why is he using steroids? Like, he's using steroids to be in the league. But if he had another one, like, the man's getting drug tested immediately. Man has one good game. Like, roll out all of the drug tests. The full battery. Yeah. Like, what is this guy on?
Yeah, he has a double-double. They got, like, a whole lab dedicated to analyzing his blood.
Yeah. It still just feels like Cleveland's outmatched. It feels like a cop-out answer to say, hey, if they start raining threes, Strus is at 30% on the playoffs. What was he at during the regular season? He's only 35 on the regular season. I feel like any time I watch Cleveland, Strus has a game. But they're also short Dean Wade. Yeah. So like they're short Allen, they're short Wade. I don't know. I think it's probably too much to ask for Cleveland. They won their one series. They got a game off Boston. If they get two games off Boston, I think it's been a successful year. I recant my need for them to blow it up. I had said that if Cleveland took more than five games to beat Orlando, they should just call it quits and start looking to trade everyone. I think if you get two games off Boston, it's a good enough year. You don't need to blow it up.
Yeah. It does just seem like one of these series where one team just has a lot more talent than the other, both at the top, but also without Dean Wade, without Jared Allen, you know, you get really thin and all of a sudden Marcus Morris is getting minutes. Not to keep picking on him. Maybe the three-point shooting is a way that they can get back into it. Like, can we get some more Sam Merrill? You know, the best volume shooter in the NBA per minute. Is that a way that they can get some offense?
I'd love to see more Merrill minutes. But I am just picking Boston in five. That's my official on the record take. Where are you going with this?
I think so, yeah. Like, especially when you consider it's not even like, you know, it's not like if Donovan Mitchell can just play better. Like, he's playing pretty well, and it doesn't really matter. Like, they're just outmatched in this.
All right, to the big one. Denver, Minnesota. The road team has won every game thus far. We've got game four tipping off half hour after we record this. So whatever we say will be instantly outdated with Jamal Murray. He has been targeted on defense. A lot of Minnesota action is trying to get him switched to guarding either Naz Reid or Karl-Anthony Towns, either of which can post him up or kind of bully drive through him. Did not look good the first two games. Game three, Denver was able to kind of invert that matchup and instead on offense get him to attack Kat or Naz. I feel like he's going to be the X factor of whether he can win this or not. How are you feeling about his play and performance thus far this series?
Yeah, I agree. I do think that he's going to be the difference maker. I would even go further and say it's the Nuggets' backcourt. If KCP is able to make shots and provide some value there, you know, get a nice 5 from 7 from 3 again, then that is the way that the Nuggets are going to be able to succeed. It's sort of bizarre that we are in this position where the Nuggets so easily won game three. It really did seem like through the first two games that Minnesota just had them figured out. Like, even without Gobert in game two, they were able to you know, really create trouble. You know, Naz Reid picking up Jokic three-quarter court, turning him in the backcourt. it seemed like they had it sort of figured out. My hot take that I don't necessarily believe, but I'm interested to hear your thoughts. Do you think that Minnesota are exposing the Nuggets for a level of like gimmicky play that it's not necessarily that they have been so much better than everyone else, or that Jokic has been so much better than everyone else. But because they do it in such a different way that the league wasn't ready for, having a big man who was able to facilitate and score where you now need a specific matchup that a lot of teams just don't have, just don't play two bigs who can, you know, one who can defend in the post and one who can defend the rim. And that Minnesota, either by coincidence or by design, has actually perfected the way that you do defend Denver, which is you have to have a perimeter player to defend Murray. You have to have a four-man who's got at least size to defend Jokic, and then you have a rim-protecting five. Do you think that they have cracked the code and that the league is going to be able to replicate this in a way that mitigates Denver's you know, superiority over the league?
Oh, I think the Lakers kind of showed the blueprint last year in the four-game sweep, because they did put Rui on and Jokic to kind of body them, have AD as a bit more of the roamer, same thing that Minnesota's doing with Kat on Gobert, and then Kat on Jokic, Gobert as the roamer. And Lakers use Jared Vanderbilt to chase around Jamal Murray, and instead Pippa has either Alexander Walker, or they actually have been using Anthony Edwards on him some, and McDaniels. Like, so I've seen the template or the blueprint out there. I think the Murray injury, how he was not looking good the first couple of games, definitely played a factor in it. But I want to give Minnesota a lot of credit, because coming into the playoffs, they were built to stop Denver. They had this two big lineup. That's the whole point and purpose of getting Gobert. I thought they were going to really struggle against Phoenix, because Phoenix has an entirely different offensive blueprint. They have a lot of mid-range. They've got a lot of ISO guys. Denver has this free-flowing in offense where a lot of cutters around Jokic. I mean, he is the central point, but he can find anyone. I thought Minnesota was built to defend that, but they switched up their defense. They defended Phoenix way better than I expected them to, than I thought they would. And so, like, I don't think it's a luck or a complete design. I think this is a really good defensive team that could take on anybody. I think at this point, well, after game two, they started to become my title favorite. I was seeing how they could just dismantle the Celtics. Game three, I think I saw every bad habit that I've seen in Minnesota kind of crop its ugly head back in. You had Kat kind of gunning for his own stuff, engaged defensively. Nikhil Alexander Walker, a bit too high of a motor and not enough of a focus, which has been one of my critiques of him over the course of the year. And then McDaniels' offense has just utterly abandoned him this series. He is shooting 30% from the floor. And I know he's provided a ton of other value out there, but part of his value being a spacer, a 3-and-D guy. And if he's not going to score, not going to look to drive, that does make life easier for Denver. So I'm not quite ready to give up on the Nuggets just yet.
Yeah. And I mean, game three was definitely an indicator that, you know, they do still have ways to succeed. Jokic is still, you know, an offense unto himself, and Jamal Murray can still be that playoff, you know, initiator and finisher, the guy that finishes the plays that Jokic is able to create. But going back to how we started this, I think it's going to come down to whether Murray, but also KCP, are able to make the shots that Jokic is able to create for them. If those guys are going to knock them down, then Denver has a chance. If they are going to be up and down, then this is one for the Wolves to take. What did you think of the way Edwards looked in game three?
Wasn't the biggest. I mean, it wasn't a good Edwards game. I do think he's looked really nice over the course of the series. I'm actually trying to remember what Edwards even looked like in game three. I've got all my notes, but just not as aggressive, not out there much, not trying as much. You know, he's a guy that we always talk about having that dog in him and having that aggression, that fire. I don't feel like I saw him much in game three. Am I missing something? Or, you know, I've watching a lot of basketball, it's starting to bleed together, but
yeah. Maybe this is a telling stat that supports your idea on lack of aggressiveness. 37 minutes, 19 points, 53% from the field goal, 53% from the field. So playing a lot of minutes, making the shots that he takes, and only putting together 19 points.
Yeah, and 9 points in the first half. It's an efficient night for him, but kind of a quiet night. It's one of the nights where you guys see him try to take more. Although Denver got up big pretty early, and I kind of worry about Minnesota just having taken their foot off the gas, off you know, the hey, we had a chance to finish Denver at home, and they just didn't do it, didn't step on the throat.
Yeah. I mean, it's a shame the way that these things work out time-wise, because this game four is going to be fascinating. You know, this could be the game of the playoffs. This is the one that's going to determine whether Denver are still, you know, the favorites to come out of the West, or if Minnesota is now a legitimate championship contender, when, you know, everyone, myself included, were writing them off as a regular season team before the playoffs started.
Yeah. I was reminded that Denver did come back from a 3-1 deficit during the Jokic era. You, as a Clippers fan, I'm sure had firsthand experience watching that in the bubble. I say that to say that, you know, there is still a chance that they can come back if they do lose game four. But one of the big things with Denver was their commitment to the young guys, the kind of two timelines, or maybe not two timelines, but if we bring in and develop young players, the Christian Braun, the Watson, that is a way to have cheaper rotation pieces, as opposed to trying to always go out and trade for another veteran or try to sign guys on the minimum. I think this series
is going to be Bruce Brown.
Yeah. Yeah. Like, Justin Holiday has been probably the best nugget off the bench over the course of this playoff run. That's Reggie, but Christian Brown and Peyton Watson have not looked particularly great. And I think that's very worrisome.
Yeah. And in certain ways, they, you know, investing in those guys was necessitated by just like the salary cap. You can't really go out and continue to add good players when you're already a team with a lot of salary. Mm-hmm. The league has made it harder and harder for teams that are already good to improve by adding more players. And also Denver low-key is kind of cheap. They don't want to be a high tax team, despite being in the midst of a championship run. And so it was essential for them to invest in Braun and in Peyton Watson, but those guys, like you say, haven't been able to play at all. And Justin Holiday, who was almost unplayable in the regular season, now as a veteran who like knows how to do some stuff, becomes essential. I think that's one of the things that has been exposed in Denver is a lack of depth, which I think I might have said coming into last season, which didn't play out at all. You know, they're able to get contributions from their lower end bench guys, but they got even shallower this year and now are really struggling for, you know, a sixth player, you know, a guy that can do anything, you know, a Bruce Brown who can attack a closeout, get downhill and make a play.
Yeah. And I felt like we won in game two. Denver reverted back to Magic style sets with Aaron Gordon. Like, there was way too much Aaron Gordon being the ball handler, trying to do stuff. I think the way that they're going to win this is by Aaron Gordon kind of hitting his shots, but not necessarily being on ball. Like, if he can space out a little bit, pull Gobert, open up the paint, and then duck in when Gobert goes out. Like, that's going to be the most useful thing. Having him on ball, as much as we saw in games one and game two, is not a grand plan.
Yeah, the one set that I do like him on ball in is as the ball handler in a pick and roll with Jokic, where you can sort of get Gobert either to have to work around the screen or to switch off of Gordon when now it's Towns who has to take on the help assignment, where he's, you know, Rudy Gobert is a generational defensive anchor and Karl Towns is not. But yeah, but it's if it's not Murray, they are going to struggle for anyone else to do anything. You know, are we going to have one more Reggie Jackson game, one more Reggie Jackson playoff game in this run?
One of my favorite podcasts, friend of the show, Ben Golliver, coined the term root canal Reggie several years back for the idea that watching Reggie Jackson is as painful as a root canal. And that's not how I felt watching.
I forgot about that one, actually.
It's a great, great call out. We're gonna have to nickname some players on this show. But what's your official prediction? And then I got something else that I want to talk about.
It's all going to depend on this game four. Like I said in every series, whoever wins the next game is going to win. if the Nuggets can even it up and then, you know, it's a three game series, or they can, if they can find a way to win this game that is repeatable, then they have a chance. But otherwise, it may be looking like a, you know, Minnesota lost focus, like you said, took the foot off the gas, more playing with purpose and less with a purpose from the likes of Nikhil, who you mentioned. If they can just get back to doing what they did so well in the early series in game four, and all of a sudden it's 3-1 and they're going home, it could be a very short series. And I would probably still favor Minnesota at this point. I mean, they've looked like the best team overall throughout the playoffs.
Yeah, this may be an incredibly dumb take, not a spicy take by any means, but there will not be a game in this series. Either Denver has figured them out and they storm back and win in six, or Minnesota takes this game and then maybe this is only going to be six games. Yeah, I'm calling it now. No matter what, Denver either has this figured out, Murray's healthy enough, win,
yeah,
or Minnesota,
or they don't, and Minnesota closes it out in five.
Yeah. So I've been, I don't know if you've noticed, but I've had the jersey wall behind me of the playoff teams. Today there's a different jersey on the wall that is not the Thunder, the Timberwolves, or the Sonics, Nuggets. There is the Atlanta Hawks. Do you know why I have the Hawks on the wall today?
They had the incredible good luck of winning the number one pick in a really bad draft.
The Hawks have won the NBA lottery. I thought that one might have snuck past you. I know that happened, what, 7.5 hours ago?
It did happen while I was asleep, yeah.
Yeah, I was going to say. It's probably like, I don't know, 2 a.m. for you, 3 a.m.?
Mm-hmm.
You haven't been digging into the prospects, have you?
Not at all. I couldn't even tell you. I couldn't name a player from this draft.
Well, that's
from what I understand, though, the number one prospect is a rim-running center, so I'm already out.
It's either that or an all guy somewhat comparable to like Jaden McDaniels or Jabari Smith Jr., which is a fine player. It's a good player to have, but not a franchise.
So your options are rim-running center or 3-and-D role player?
Yeah.
Wow. That's exciting.
Which, that does tamper down the expectations of like, oh, Atlanta got number one pick, what can they do? But Atlanta, I think, has an interesting chance to do something this offseason. They've kind of had too many mouths to feed and not enough ball to go around. Between having either Trey and Murray that they want to split up, or having this number one pick, they got a lot of options on where they could go this offseason. What do you think would be a smart offseason plan for the Hawks?
It's tough, because normally a team like this who's like stuck in this weird position of, you know, needing to do something radical and then getting the number one pick is like, okay, perfect. There we go. There's our next franchise guy. We can blow it up. We'll just move both of these guys, get what we can in return, and we'll build around this number one pick. But when you're getting it in a weak draft, makes it such a lot more tougher of a choice. I do think they need to trade. You know, they can't keep both of these guys. They need to trade one of them. They tried to trade DeJounte at the deadline and, you know, couldn't get anything for him. So maybe it is Trey who's on the move. I think Clint Capella is off contract as well. So like, you would hope this would be a chance to invest in Okongwu, but if you're going to draft a center over top of him, that makes that awkward again. You know, is this build around the number one overall pick in Jalen Johnson time? That doesn't sound appetizing. and so maybe instead it's a chance to double down. Maybe it is moving the number one overall pick, moving Trae Young or DeJounte and bringing in another star, and really make a good run at getting the 8 seed.
So I am seeing Landry Field saying that trading the number one pick is not on the Hawks' radar. I don't think they came in with any sort of plans of, hey, what happens if we get the number one pick? They had such a slim chance of getting it. It probably wasn't even a foggiest idea of trading. It does have one more year left, but the Hawks' cap sheet is roughly, like, Trey is under contract slash has a player option in 26-27. DeAndre Hunter, $25 million, 26-27. Johnny Murray under contract till 27-28. Okongwu, it's not a bad contract, but Under contract till 27-28. Like, they've got some big contracts on the books. By any other draft, I would say this is your chance. Blow it up. Mm. Everybody but Jalen Johnson, number one pick, and Vic Krenchie, like, everyone else can go. Maybe keep Bruno. I feel like he's a good guy. But everyone else can be gone. Since it is a rough draft, I don't know that you do that, but I am interested to see what you can get from the Spurs. Supposedly they didn't love parting with DeJounte Murray. It's what they needed to do to tank out. They have Hawks picks. Get some of your own picks back. Spurs, another winner of the lottery, being able to draft as they drop from 7 to 8, as well as having the number 4 pick. It's not, you know, they would have preferred to have the number 1, but they got to have 2. They got to keep 2 lottery picks. I think that Spurs deal now more than ever, and maybe the Spurs give up. I don't know what the Spurs could give up to the Hawks. Would want enough for the number 1 pick, but they could pair the Frenchman together. It could be a French pretty with Victor. I don't know how to pronounce his name, but just saying.
Would like DeJounte and 1 for 4, 8 and their own pick back? Would that be terrible value?
DeJounte and the number 1 pick for 8 and their own pick back? No, that's terrible.
And their own pick.
4, 8 and their future pick.
Yeah. Bearing in mind that they tried to trade DeJounte and he's perceived as a negative asset around the league.
That's fair. The DeJounte, though, was prior to the Trae Young injury when everything went better for Hawks. Like, I'm just saying, I don't know the great perception at this point. Like, Murray played really well without Trae, and I think that probably is his value.
Yeah.
I also think the Hawks may have been asking too much because I know the Lakers would have traded away D'Lo for him in a heartbeat. And that D'Lo contract is, I forget, it's not guaranteed or it's shorter. If it's just a negative contract and you want to get him long term, that deal was open and available. So it can't be that bad.
But I do like the idea of trading down in a weak draft. Because if you think about the weak drafts in the past, it's not necessarily that like there's no talent. It's just that the future star players aren't the guys that you identify correctly. And so, you know, think about like 2015, is it? Where you get like, who's it, Anthony Bennett at number 1, but then you get Giannis at 15 or whatever. So these quote unquote weak drafts, you know, scouts and that sort of thing are good at picking where the top is weak. But no one really has an idea of what's going to come out of, you know, the lottery.
Yeah. I like that. Maybe just 1 for 8 and or 4 and 8, like just get 2 shots at the apple as opposed to 1. I don't know that the Spurs would want to do that, but you know, maybe they really see something they like in Sarr, and having Sarr and Victor would be a good chance. I kind of like what I've seen from Toppin, and as just a creative point guard with good size, they desperately need a point guard. You know, it could be interesting.
It's not a great point guard free agent market either. Drafting a point guard does seem like quite an important move, given that they like want to take a step forward next season. Wemby's going to be too good to be a bottom 5 team again and get another high pick. But they're not going to get to any sort of offensive level without a real point guard over the next couple of years. And so maybe drafting a point guard is there, you know, is ideal for them.
Yeah. And it looks like there's a lot of point guards in that 4 to 8 range. Just kind of checking a couple different drafts right now. Both Sarr and the other guy are both French. So 1 and 2 on most of the mock boards are Frenchmen. So I'm just saying, San Antonio, you could have a double French guy, a big front court, or, you know, maybe Rob Dillingham, Nikola Topic. I think there's got to be somewhere else. Topic? Reach out. Like, they got some options. That's for guys. But I think, you know, those are the two big winners. Detroit fall back to back. They got off the winning a lot. They fell to 5. That is brutal. I know Pistons fans are big living in Michigan. They crawled under a crane, but back to back years, having number 1 odds and falling to 5 is just so unlucky.
Yeah. And like, that's the kind of thing that can like doom you as a franchise. If you look at some of these teams that like went through a rebuild and then like had to blow up their rebuild because it just failed, dropping down the draft board, missing out on high quality players for more mediocre kind of players. Like, that's the kind of thing that dooms your rebuild. And for them who have, you know, maybe like a potential number one in Cade and then not a whole lot else, like, they really do need another star. And so to once again fall out of the range where, you know, you're statistically most likely to get that guy is, you know, could be a real killer for them.
Yeah. I mean, you think about it. If the Pistons had won the draft lottery last year and got Victor Wembanyama, Troy Weaver probably looks like a dude. Troy Weaver, you know, has this young core. It's anchored on both ends by Cade and by Victor. And I think Victor could have played with Jalen Duren. Because Duren is much more of a running big. They've shown a little bit of spacing. He's working with Rashard Lewis to kind of get some handles and get some shooting. But those two, it's an empowering find. Now the Pistons GM looks great, but you get bad lottery luck, and that's why it's a lottery. That's why it's luck. And any other
Wimby and Cade, if you ended up with both of those, I think we're falling behind in the connection.
Yeah.
Do you want to wrap here? We're breaking up a lot.
That's what I was going to do. Was just leading to wrapping. If you don't have any final takes, Dylan, where can they find you?
Every week, except for when I catch the plague, on the Hoops Temple podcast, you can send an email to hoopstemple@gmail.com with any questions, any comments. You could follow me on TikTok at President of Basketball Conversations. If I get to 1 million followers, I will produce a video. Every week on the Hoops Temple podcast.
Yeah. You can also join us in the Discord. Link in the show notes. If you click the Discord link, you can need to plug it with the browser. But we'd love to talk to you. You can also find me, Nate_HoopsTemple, on TikTok. I'd love to hear from you guys. Have a good week.